Greece says its deficit is still too high and its budget will be cut even more.
Yet the Greek people say they're the ones paying the price.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Monday, October 3rd.
Coming up, it's been 3 years since our government bailed out the banks. Have things improved?
It's back to work for the Supreme Court, and they've got a lot of work to do.
And later, Arrested Development makes a comeback.
These stories and more on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business, providing automatic online backup solutions for small businesses and the computer files they depend on. Learn more and receive a free trial at Carbonite.com with code Marketplace.
The Greek government today announced a proposal to cut 30,000 state workers. That's just today after the country's finance minister said Greece will not meet its deficit target this year, part of Europe's demand in order to loan the country billions of dollars to avoid default. Christos Michalidis is current affairs editor at the Athens Daily Eleftherotypia. Christos, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Is there any surprise that the Greek government says it's going to miss its financial targets?
Well, there's no surprise for anything anymore here in Greece. People have stopped believing anything whatsoever, I must tell you. The government still believes that it is going to get the sixth installment of the loan from the IMF and the European Central Bank. But it's not very likely at the moment. They have announced a new package of austerity measures late last night, and it's quite a heavy package on the backs of people, but still it doesn't seem to be enough.
Now, I know the Vouli has passed a measure that would cut tens of thousands of jobs. How is that going to affect the country?
Right. Well, this needs to be voted on by Parliament. The discussion is going to start today, and by the end of the week, we're going to have the final decision. We don't expect any surprises. PASOK, the socialist government, has a majority in Greek Parliament, and we haven't noticed any MPs at the moment who are willing to vote against this notion.
How do Greek citizens look at this dilemma? I mean, obviously, the country could go into default, or it could be saved, but on, like you say, the backs of many Greeks.
The Greek people right now are very, very demoralized. Not because their money has become less, not because their salaries have been cut by about between 30 up to 50%. They are demoralized, most of them, because they don't see an end to all this. They don't see their government going ahead with other structural measures, and they're only seeing their government cutting the salaries of everyday working simple people. So it's a very sad situation.
Christos Michalidis, who's the political correspondent there in Athens for the Eleftherotypia newspaper. Christos, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.
Here at home, it's the third anniversary of our own bailout, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, which got us wondering just how stable is our financial system today. For that, we turn to Julia Coronado, chief economist for North America at BNP Paribas in New York. She joins us now. Good morning, Julia.
Good morning.
So TARP was controversial at the time. We're now 3 years out. How healthy are the U.S. financial institutions right now?
Well, they've definitely come a long way since 2008. They have done a lot of capital restoration and working through the losses from the mortgage crisis. So they're definitely at much lower levels of debt and much higher levels of capital. I think right now the concerns that we're seeing in the market revolve more around the global economy and what that means for future losses or delinquencies on the loans that they extend. And secondarily, in a world of a slower economy and tighter regulation, how are they going to be able to actually grow their revenue streams?
Now, is that need for a revenue stream the reason we're seeing these new bank fees from Bank of America, which is going to charge a $5 a month debit card fee, or Citibank charging new checking account fees?
Absolutely. If you think about, you know, years back where you used to pay a fee for your checking account, and that was also a world where we didn't really have debit cards. Then we went to a world with debit cards. Banks put these fees on. They earned a lot of their revenue that way, and then were able to entice customers with free checking. Now that that route of revenue has been closed off by regulation, now they're going to have to make their money some way or another. They're going to have to, you know, they provide a service. They need to charge a certain amount for that service in order to stay profitable and cover their costs. So I think we are headed to a world with higher banking fees.
Julia Coronado is chief economist for North America at BNP Paribas. Thanks.
It's my pleasure.
Well, the Supreme Court kicks off a new term today. They're going to be tackling some interesting business cases involving generic drugs, copyrights, and patents. But one of the most watched cases this term focuses on Medicaid, a federal-state program that provides medical care for the poor. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
The case looks at whether Medicaid patients and providers like doctors have the right to sue a state if it slashes Medicaid payments. The state in question, cash-strapped California. In 2008, it cut Medicaid rates by 10%. Federal law says states, which set Medicaid rates, have to pay enough to ensure that providers accept Medicaid patients. A group of providers sued California, saying the state was violating that law.
They do have the right to sue. It's critical to ensure access to health care.
That's AARP lawyer Barbara Jones. She says as it is, Medicaid patients can hardly find doctors because Medicaid pays so little. Matt Salo is executive director of the National Association of Medicaid Directors. He says if Medicaid providers are allowed to sue, they will choke the courts with lawsuits.
And it will drag every state into prolonged litigation that they can't afford to fight.
Salo says that would leave states with even less money to pay Medicaid providers. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Global air travel lost a little altitude in August. The International Air Transport Association says passenger travel was down more than 1.5%.
Fiat says it's going to start building Jeep SUVs by the end of 2013 at one of its factories in Turin, Italy. Fiat owns Chrysler and Jeep. More numbers, of course, at our website, marketplace.org. You can get the podcast while you're there. And, Adrian, we invite all the people who listen to this podcast to tell us what you think of the podcast once you download it.
If you like us,
nice.
If you don't, we want to hear it.
Please.
You can also follow us on Twitter at Marketplace Radio.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business. Carbonite Business is an online automatic backup solution designed specifically for small businesses. Carbonite Business automatically and continually backs up computer files to a secure offsite location. In the event of a hard drive crash, virus, or other computer problem, files can easily be recovered. To learn more about Carbonite Business and to receive a free trial, visit Carbonite.com and use the code Marketplace.
Will protests over the inequality between Wall Street and the rest of us continue in spots all over the country?
Now, they call themselves Occupy Wall Street, and some of the signs held up at rallies in New York read, "Honk if you have student debt."
There must have been a lot of honking.
Yeah, a lot of people have student debt, Adrian. Student loan debt accounts for $830 billion. A popular online petition fueled by those protests proposes to forgive all student loan debt to boost the American economy.
So what do student loans have to do with Wall Street? Here's Marketplace's Gregory Warner.
This is not your mother's student loan. Donna Cooper is a senior fellow with the economic policy team at American Progress, and when she graduated in the 1980s, her student loan was $80 a month.
These days, kids are graduating where their student loan payments are close to $1,000 a month, and the possibility of getting a job where you're going to have that much income beyond what your basic necessities are is very slim.
Wall Street trades in student loan debt, just as it does mortgages. And just as that Wall Street capital spurred unsavory lending practices in the housing market, it encouraged private student loan companies to aggressively market to families.
So families might, or parents of kids might, extend themselves further than they would have otherwise because they can get an affordable student loan.
But those private interest rates in this economy turn out not to be so affordable. Defaults jumped 27% this year. I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Well, over the weekend, more than 700 protesters were arrested in the Occupy Wall Street rallies. And as Tracy Samuelson now reports, those protests are starting to draw a different crowd.
For the past 2 weeks, there have been a couple hundred protesters occupying Zuccotti Park, a small patch of open space in New York's financial district. They've been mostly young, scruffy, unemployed. But Sunday, they were joined by more mature, professional types. Michelle Gittleman teaches global business at Rutgers University. She calls herself the last of the middle class.
I think that anything like this starts out a little fringy, but hopefully it'll speak to a lot of so quote-unquote regular people who are feeling the pain.
Gittleman joined die-hard protesters like Miriam Rocek, who's starting her third week in the park. Saturday marked her second arrest. But she says it's only made her more determined to stay.
Yeah, we're only getting stronger. Every time they arrest people, more people show up.
Part of that new support is coming from organized labor. Tim Dubnow is with Communication Workers of America.
This is really what democracy looks like, right? And when students, when labor, when community groups join together, we can start saying enough is enough.
His union and other labor groups are expected to formally join the protest with a march on Wednesday. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Today marks the start of New York's Advertising Week, where some new marketing powerhouses will headline events. Google, Facebook, and Yahoo are seen as Silicon Valley phenoms, but as digital advertising soars, Madison Avenue is becoming a second home. Sally Herships has more.
Yahoo's new offices in Times Square have white leather couches, purple lights, and floor-to-ceiling windows overlooking Midtown Manhattan.
This is really more kind of a lofty look, which is more like an agency on Madison Avenue.
Wayne Powers runs Yahoo's North American ad sales. He says raising Yahoo's profile in New York's advertising market is critical. Yahoo moved into its new space about 6 weeks ago. Twitter is shopping around, and Google has claimed an entire city block for itself.
Google, of course, didn't just sign a lease. They bought a building.
Ken McCarthy oversees research at real estate broker Cushman Wakefield. He says internet companies are so hungry for office space that buildings in some Manhattan areas haven't been this full for 7 years.
The Midtown South market is the tightest market in the country.
But getting in is vital to woo internet-wary clients. So says Patty McWilliams. She teaches marketing at Wharton.
A lot of these traditional advertisers still find all this stuff to be a little newfangled.
But new media's profit model is a classic.
They may be delivering new fashion tools and allowing consumers to connect in ways that maybe they couldn't as well before, but they're making money in a pretty old-fashioned kind of way.
Selling ads. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Well, down south in Florida, the state has moved next year's Republican presidential primary to late January, which puts it ahead of other traditionally early caucus and primary states, which may just move up their primaries as well, because campaigning candidates bring in a lot of money. From Washington, here's Marketplace's John Dimsdale.
New Hampshire state law requires that its presidential primary be the nation's first, 1 week before all others. Iowa holds the first party caucuses, even before any primaries.
It's not simply a matter of prestige. You can't eat prestige.
Election expert Larry Sabato at the University of Virginia says there's plenty of money at stake.
When you look at what these primaries and caucuses produce for the early states, it's really remarkable. Somewhere between tens of millions and hundreds of millions of dollars for the local economies.
Hotels, restaurants, and TV stations are big winners in early presidential primaries. A study of New Hampshire's 2000 primary, when both parties had contests, found candidates and their entourage of campaigners and media earned the state $264 million. But the financial benefits may be exaggerated. In 2008, Iowa State University professor Dave Swenson figured he'd measure Iowa's windfall that year, and when he looked closely at what campaigns were spending, he was underwhelmed.
They spent most of their money in Virginia and Washington, D.C. And what were they buying with that money? Well, first off, they have to raise money. And New Hampshire and Iowa aren't where you're going to go to raise money. So you're going to hire media consultants, you're going to hire fundraisers, and you're going to go to where money is. And again, that's not Iowa or New Hampshire.
There's another benefit to an early primary. A state can get attention for a pet issue. Exhibit A, says Larry Sabato, would be ethanol subsidies that don't do much for energy conservation, but are a big help for Iowa's corn farmers.
Candidates are going to do anything they have to do to win one of those early contests. And if that means promising things to special interests that make no sense for the national interest, most of them are more than happy to do it.
Without Iowa's early caucuses, some wonder whether ethanol would be in our gasoline at all. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The Kennel Club in the UK has suspended plans to test show dogs for banned substances. And we're not talking puppy steroids
here,
Steve.
Yeah, I was going to say, what kind of substances are we talking about with dogs?
Well, grooming products like hairspray apparently are off limits.
Wait. People use hairspray on their dogs?
It's all about the shine, Steve. You got to get that hair in place.
Oh, man.
According to The Telegraph, at a recent show, every dog the Kennel Club tested was positive for these things.
For hairspray.
Hairspray and other grooming products. I guess on a white dog, chalk can make them look even whiter.
Oh, wow.
So the club has backed off the rules for the time being. One opponent of the ban told the paper limiting hairspray at dog shows is like asking Miss World to go on without her makeup. Today, growers of pistachios are voting on whether to increase industry oversight. The thinking is it could make those little green nuts more attractive to overseas importers and expand the market for pistachios abroad. Jennifer Collins reports.
Horizon Nut Company in California's Central Valley hulls, cleans, and sorts almost 10% of the U.S. pistachio crop every year.
What we're looking for is an unstained, as bright a white or cream-colored shell as possible.
J.D. Franklin is the head of operations. Every so often, he does his own quality control checks.
Heavenly!
That heavenly taste can take at least 6 years. But when the trees mature, they produce for decades. Jim Zion of a grower cooperative says that's attracted unlikely financial backers.
The stock market obviously is not a place to go, and so you have seen some retirement funds coming in.
And partly that's because
the return on pistachios has been quite good.
Bob Klein oversees pistachio production in the U.S. By some accounts, investors can triple their money in 20 years. Klein says those returns have created a nutty situation with the largest processor in the industry, Paramount Farms. Maybe you've heard its tagline.
Get cracking.
Klein says Paramount split from a trade group a few years ago over marketing disagreements.
The large processor said, well, we pay the bulk of the assessments, so we should have more say than we currently have.
Now, Paramount pays the bulk of the advertising, reportedly $30 million a year. This fall, the smaller producers ramp up their own campaign. They spend about $5 million on promotions here and overseas.
Each side would say that the other ones are irrational and illogical.
But Klein says that rivalry may be a good thing in the long run.
Anything that puts pistachios in people's minds will make them more likely to buy.
And with the crop potentially doubling in a few years, he says there's about to be a lot more pistachios for people to buy. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
More than 100,000 prisoners in Florida are no longer able to light up cigarettes, leading up to a ban that started last weekend. One of the country's largest prison populations spent 6 months being weaned off of tobacco. Reporter Gina Jordan has more from Tallahassee.
The ban was ordered by former Corrections Secretary Edwin Buss, who banned tobacco as corrections chief in Indiana in the mid-1990s. Going tobacco-free in the prisons will save the state of Florida a lot of money, according to Gretel Plessinger with the prison system.
Last calendar year, we spent almost $9 million on hospital bills for inmates with smoking-related illnesses.
For skeptics who predicted an angry uprising of tobacco-addicted inmates, there have been none so far. As soon as the ban was announced, inmates were able to buy nicotine patches and take classes to help them kick the habit. Plessinger says the inmates may just be trading one habit for another.
What we've seen in other states is that when inmates stop smoking, they buy candy instead.
Florida inmates spent $19 million at the prison canteen last year on tobacco products. Of course, that's just a blip in terms of profit for the tobacco companies. Plessinger says none of those companies have called to complain. In Tallahassee, I'm Gina Jordan for Marketplace.
Well, speaking of prison, some exciting news, Adrian. Cue the tape.
Tell me the truth, okay? Because there's been a lot of lying in this family.
And a lot of love.
A lot of love.
A lot of love. We learned yesterday that the TV show Arrested Development will make a comeback. If you're unfamiliar, it's a Fox show about a very mixed up family that critics and fans seem to love, but it had sort of lackluster ratings. It was canceled after 3 seasons.
Yeah.
Now the show's creator says they're planning to shoot 10 or so new shows leading up to a movie. There's no release date yet, but for those of us who are fans, it is exciting news.
Exciting.
Yes. Here to talk with us in a Marketplace Mid-Date Update podcast exclusive about how exactly this show came back from the dead is Dave Itzkoff, culture reporter for the New York Times. Hi, Dave.
Hey, how are you?
So how does this happen, that 5 years later, a show like Arrested Development comes back?
Well, it's something that Mitchell Hurwitz, the creator of the show, and stars like Jason Bateman and Will Arnett have been talking about for a while and alluding to in interviews, that they've at the very least wanted to do a movie that would continue the story of the Bluth family characters from the show. What the big surprise was yesterday, there was an event at the New Yorker Festival that reunited the cast for the first time since the show ended and brought them back together with Mitch Hurwitz. And at this event, he said that not only are they planning a film, but he wants to do essentially almost a new season of the show. It'd be sort of 9 or 10, you know, episodes that would reintroduce all the characters, show us where they've been in the 5 years since the series went off the air, and then that would lead us back to whatever the plot of the movie is going to be.
Hey, Dave, which is it? Is it like the DVD sales and Netflix, or is it the power of cult hits? You know, we know that a lot of shows have devout fans and big followings. I mean, is that what's going on here?
I think it's a little bit of all of that, yes. I think certainly in the time since the show went off the air, we've seen the rise of DVR recording, people buying entire seasons of shows on DVD to watch in one shot, people watching shows on Netflix and Hulu. So a lot of people are either rediscovering the show, immersing themselves in it. I think for a movie studio, there's also, you know, they don't like to put out films anymore that people don't already have at least some kind of baseline familiarity with the property or the characters, that there at least be some sort of, you know, interest that will get people through the door, get that first weekend audience in, and then spread the word to all their friends.
So. It used to be, Dave, right, when a show would go off the air, the only chance you'd have to see it again is if it were in syndication, right?
Exactly. But I think that it was a show that, you know, not only has like a really passionate fan base, but ended in a very abrupt way, that their final season, their episode order kept getting cut. And there was certainly a sense, I think, on you know, both on the part of the people making the show and the people watching it, that it didn't sort of end on the terms that anybody was really satisfied with. So there was always a feeling that this is a story that could continue, that there was more to be said about these people.
Now, if this movie gets made, is it likely to be a successful movie? I mean, I feel like other TV shows turned into movies have done maybe not so well. And here, Smurfs is coming to mind.
Yay, Smurfs. All right.
Yeah, it is certainly a crapshoot. And, you know, I think it depends upon, you know, what kind of scale they do it on. You have to imagine that it probably will not be a very high-budgeted film. I mean, at this point, you know, the biggest stars are people like Jason Bateman and Michael Cera, who have their followings, but, you know, they're not, you know, George Clooney quite yet. So on those terms, you know, if it's made in a small enough way, I'm sure it will at least be satisfying to the diehard fans of the show. Whether it, you know, really translates into box office is hard to say. But it could also have its own sort of second life on DVD and Netflix, that people, you know, watch it in perpetuity in places like that.
And again, we have no release date on this as yet.
Yeah, exactly. At this stage, it's something that Hurwitz is just talking about, but certainly I think the announcement that he made yesterday had, you know, a lot of impact and a lot of media coverage, and if he wasn't already talking to, you know, possible studio partners, I think this is certainly going to be the catalyst to either finally make it happen or finally get them to stop talking about it.
Literally to be continued.
Exactly.
Dave Itzkoff from the New York Times. Dave, thanks.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And finally, a new Danish tax, Adrian, on high-fat items just went into effect over the weekend.
Now, I'm sitting here with a furrowed brow. What are you talking
What's
about?
What's that furrowed brow you have? Well, there's a tax on that as well, a tax on furrowed brows. No, we're talking about a tax on high-fat content, like things you would find in, you know, junk foods or, you know, French fries, potato chips, things like that.
Now, how much extra is eating fatty going to cost me if I'm in Denmark?
If you're in Denmark, and this is just for the Danish people in Denmark, like 15 cents extra for the price of a cheeseburger.
And what about a big old stick of butter?
Oh, a stick of butter is going to cost you 40 cents more. Yeah, because there's a lot of fat in butter.
Fair enough. Right?
Yeah, you churn butter out of cream.
Which is just fat.
On the
yes.
farm, yeah. Anyway, Denmark is hoping, of course, to increase its average life expectancy while at the same time increase its revenues. Wow, what a neat byproduct. We're going to increase our revenues, too, while we're doing this by $220 million a year.
That's so, a lot of butter.
I was thinking, okay, in my little repository that I call my office, and I, you know, had the fan going, and I was like, wow, we could solve the European debt crisis after all, Adrian.
Go, how?
Well, it starts with a Greek cheeseburger, actually. Okay? So the Greeks can implement this tax, and they start making – and the Greeks are famous for making food anyway, right?
Right.
So they're making food, and they're charging extra tax, and hey, the whole debt problem in Greece is over.
European financial leaders, take note.
Take note. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Adrian Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.